Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 565, Middle East Matrix. He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages, Part 2. This is being recorded on August 20th of the year 2006. With this program, perhaps more than others, and with the sequence of programs dealing with the Middle East Matrix, and probably subtitled all of them, He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages, because that's what happens to you when you do, and I speak from experience, and I expect I will be certainly if chased, or at least there will be an attempt to chase me out of plenty of villages as a result of this. The fact of the matter is, as Winston Churchill once said, it's not enough to do one's best. Sometimes one has to do what is necessary. And we're going to be wading into the Middle East Matrix, and I'm going to be doing my best to demonstrate that, in fact, people who have simply been consuming the media product that has been presented to them, like the people who are on the inside of the Matrix in the series of popular motion pictures, are being deliberately misled by malefactors. And their view of the world is no more accurate than a view of the people who were inside the Matrix in those movies. Now, in terms of understanding what is taking place there, and this sequence of programs is going to be going on for a long time, let's begin by talking about the whole issue of Islamic fascism. There has been much breast beating, in the world, particularly in the Islamic world, Saudi Arabia in particular, about George Bush's use of the term Islamic fascist this past week. Well, you know, there's an old expression, even a broken clock is right twice a day, and George Bush, a broken clock if ever there was one, was quite right this past week when he noted that we were in a war against Islamic fascists. He's quite accurate. What he didn't say is that we are losing. I think we're going to lose in no small measure because of what he has managed to do to screw up the war. He did not mention that there are the most profound links between these Islamic fascists and the corporatist Muslim Brotherhood in particular, and the Republican Party, and the mainsprings of his own administration, such as Karl Rove and Grover Norquist and the Islamic Institute, and the multinational corporations, and the machinery of the Bretton Woods agreements. No less an authority than the World Bank has tabbed Ibn Khaldun, the Muslim Brotherhood's role model for globalization and privatization, as the first advocate of privatization. The World Bank, one should not forget, is headed up by Citizen Wolfowitz. Okay? But in point of fact, people are inside of the Matrix, and they're not told about Islamic fascism. The Saudis this past week reacted very strongly. They said that there's no such thing as Islamic fascism. Well, not only is Saudi Arabia one of the epicenters of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Islamic fascist, but the Saudis have been tied in with fascism as a whole since the very inception of that country, founded in part by not only King Abdulaziz, but also Jack Philby, a Nazi spy, and Alan Dulles, a Nazi spy as well. Philby for the British and Dulles for the Americans. And Dulles had much to do with investing American money in Nazi Germany in the first place. In discussing Islamic fascism, one cannot analyze it except in the context of world fascism, of which it is part. The Saudis, for example, hired an American neo-Nazi named William Grimstead as a Washington lobbyist in the late 1990s. They're the last people in the world who ought to be making snide noises about how there's no such thing as Islamic fascism. Because indeed there is, and Islamic fascism is inextricably linked with the whole situation vis-a-vis Israel and the Arabs. Indeed, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, Haji Amin al-Husseini, is an individual who's been associated with genocide not only in the Middle East, but under the Turkish army, in which he was an officer in World War I, for the Japanese, where he supported the Sukhching massacres in World War II of ethnic Chinese in occupied Muslim countries in the Pacific. But Haji Amin al-Husseini was a major in the SS, put together, among other fighting formations, three Waffen-SS divisions to fight alongside the Nazis in World War II. One of those was revived in Bosnia in the mid-1990s. But Haji Amin al-Husseini was the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement and had lent all of his political character to that movement. One of the brutal truths that people who are inside of the Matrix are not aware of and react violently when presented with is that the Palestinian National Movement, the fascist element in the Zionist movement, notwithstanding, it's there, and I've paid some dues for talking about it, but the Palestinian National Movement is in its entirety fascist, and it is not just fascist, it is Nazi, and it is not just Nazi, it is SS. The extent to which they have adopted all of the genocidal impetus of the Grand Mufti and his culture would be difficult to exaggerate. But it is only in understanding the reality of Islamic fascism and how that, in turn, is feeding into reaction in Israel that one can accurately grasp this. And there is no place where Islamic fascism is more evident than in Iran. I would note that in, among other programs, For the Record 352 and For the Record 456, I noted that Francois Genoux actually paid for the Ayatollah Khomeini's exile in France. Ayatollah Khomeini, the linchpin of the Islamic fundamentalist government that came to power in 79. Francois Genoux was not only one of the most important Nazi spies before, during, and after World War II. He had much to do with the post-war disbursement of Nazi monies, with the post-war diaspora of Nazi war criminals. He financed the trials of Adolf Eichmann and Klaus Barbie. He also was the heir to the collected literary works and political last will and testament of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Josef Goebbels. And he paid for Khomeini's exile. And there are very close links, for example, between Bank al-Taqwa and the mullahs in Iran. And the Iranians are the sponsors of Hezbollah. Hezbollah themselves are southern Lebanese Shia, but their officers actually speak Farsi. They're basically the equivalent of Iranian special forces. Now, speaking of Iran, we close side one talking about the fact that one of the things that German officials were on the alert for during the World Cup was demonstrations, disturbances by German neo-Nazis, who in particular were demonstrating their support for Iran and its Holocaust-denying president, Ahmadinejad, who has called for the extermination of Israel, who is working to get nuclear weapons, and who, well, let's see how the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, describes the situation. Financial Times, July 22nd, July 23rd of 2006. This is an article by Bertrand Benoit in Berlin. It's titled, Germany Intends to Ignore Bizarre, unquote, note from Tehran. It reads, the German government said yesterday it would ignore a letter sent this week by President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran to Chancellor Angela Merkel, as it addressed neither the dispute over Tehran's nuclear program nor the crisis in Lebanon. The letter from Mr. Ahmadinejad handed to the German embassy in Tehran on Wednesday contained, quote, many assertions that are not acceptable to us, particularly about Israel, its legitimacy, and the Holocaust, unquote, said Ulrich Wilhelm, Ms. Merkel's spokesman. Note again that, as noted in, among other programs, For the Record 540, moderates like us, President Ahmadinejad has denied the Holocaust while calling for Israel's extermination. Also, the head of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood has denied the Holocaust as well. Continuing with the article, Mr. Wilhelm said the Chancellor had no intention of replying and would not publish the letter, although officials said they expected Tehran to do so, as it did with a letter sent by Mr. Ahmadinejad to President George W. Bush earlier this year. One Berlin official described the 10-page letter as bizarre, unquote, drawing parallels between Iranian and German history since 1945 and the two countries' alleged oppression by Zionism, the, quote, international Jewish conspiracy, unquote, and the world's great powers. Although the Iranian president calls for cooperation between the countries, quote, his argument is surprisingly identical to that made by the German extreme right, unquote, the official said. Again quoting, there is not a single line about the nuclear program or about Lebanon or about Hezbollah, unquote. As in his 18-page letter to Mr. Bush, Mr. Ahmadinejad also elaborates extensively on the similarities between the three monotheist religions of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Defending the German government's decision not to publish the letter, the official said Berlin had no interest in helping disseminate the views expressed by the Iranian president. Ms. Merkel has been extremely critical of Mr. Ahmadinejad's anti-Semitic comments in the past. Speaking at a security conference in Munich this year, she compared his administration to that of the Nazis in 1930s Germany. Interrupting, this is the Chancellor of Germany, folks. This isn't Dave Emery. One more time. Speaking at a security conference in Munich this year, she compared his administration to that of the Nazis in 1930s Germany. Israel and the West have accused Iran and Syria of providing direct military and financial support to Hezbollah that has helped the Lebanon-based militia launch destructive rocket attacks on Israeli towns, an accusation that Tehran denies. Germany said it would continue to support efforts by the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council to draft a resolution that would force Iran to suspend its nuclear enrichment program, which they believe is geared towards building arms as a nuclear deterrent. The German official said Mr. Ahmadinejad's offer to cooperate with Germany in his letter was, quote, strange, unquote, and seemed disingenuous, given that, quote, such an offer of cooperation is part of the incentives included in the offer of negotiations, unquote. Well, again, that assessment coming not only from the Chancellor of Germany and the government of Germany, but being expressed in the Financial Times of London, basically comparing not only contemporary Iran to Germany in the 1930s, but noting the subscription on the part of Ahmadinejad and the Iranian government to Jewish conspiracy theories of a Nazi character. That, by the way, is true throughout the Middle East. You can go to virtually any luxury hotel in the Middle East and buy a copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which does not come from the Middle East. Again, if people want to understand why an anti-fascist, and that's what I am, would be in fundament supportive of Israel, not because I'm a Zionist, but because I'm an anti-fascist, take a look at the pictures of Hezbollah rallies. Same gesture by Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad. There is no gesture like that in Arabic or Islamic culture. It's the Nazi salute, and when you see somebody doing that, you better resist them, because if you don't, you would either become A, a victim, or B, a collaborator. The very history of Iran itself is inextricably linked with the whole development of not only Islamic fascism, but its development in the context of world fascism, and as I've spoken about so many times, part of the genesis of this was the Earth Island geopolitical concept and the struggle in the two world wars in the period between it and now after it for the control of territories in the Earth Island. We're going to take a look at an op-ed column that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Sunday, January 8th of 2006. This is an op-ed column by Edwin Black, the author of, among other titles, The Transfer Agreement, IBM and the Holocaust, and also most recently, The War Against the Weak. This is called Denial of Holocaust, Nothing New in Iran. Ties to Hitler led to plots against British and Jews. Note what Iran, how Iran developed. Iran, by the way, is in Farsi means Aryan or land of the Aryans. We're going to read a little bit about that history. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has shot to the forefront of Holocaust denial with his rabble-rousing remarks last month. But it's more like self-denial. The president of Iran need only look to his country's Hitler-era past to discover that Iran and Iranians were strongly connected to the Holocaust and the Hitler regime, as was the entire Islamic world under the leadership of the Mufti of Jerusalem. Iran's axis with the Third Reich began during the pre-war years when it welcomed Nazi Gestapo agents and other operatives to Tehran, allowing them to use the city as a base for Middle East agitation against the British and the region's Jews. Key among these German agents was Fritz Grubbe, Berlin's envoy to the Middle East, who was often called the German Lawrence because he promised a pan-Islamic state stretching from Casablanca to Tehran. Relations between Berlin and Tehran were strong from the moment Hitler came to power in 1933. At that time, Reza Shah Pahlavi's nation was known as Persia. The Shah became a stalwart admirer of Hitler Nazism and the concept of the Aryan master race. He also sought the Reich's help in reducing British petro-political domination. So intense was the Shah's identification with the Third Reich that in 1935 he renamed his ancient country Iran, unquote, which in Farsi means Aryan and refers to the proto-Indo-European lineage that Nazi racial theorists and Persian ethnologists cherished. The idea for the name change was suggested by the Iranian ambassador to Germany, who came under the influence of Hitler's trusted banker, Hjalmar Schacht. From that point, all Iranians were constantly reminded that their country shared a common bond with the Nazi regime. We've spoken about the Grand Mufti at great length in programs in the past, and indeed, the Grand Mufti and his influence in the Middle East could not be exaggerated. One of the people who is a link between the past and the present is a fellow named Johann von Leers. He was in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Goebbels' propaganda ministry in World War II, and he then became part of the Nazi diaspora, financed in part by François Genoux. He went first to Argentina, then eventually to Egypt, where he changed his name to Omar Amin von Leers. He became a Muslim, and he went to work as the head of the Institute for the Study of Zionism under Nasser. And in this regard, he worked very closely with other Third Reich veterans. And it's important to understand some of these people and their influence on the regimes that were trying to wipe out Israel. Because in terms of understanding how the Israelis look at things, well, this is essential. We're going to turn now to the book, The Beast Reawakens, by Martin A. Lee. Now, Johann von Leers has as one of his protégés Ahmed Huber, a director of the Bank al-Taqwa, the Bank of the Muslim Brotherhood that, among other institutions, has been financing al-Qaeda, although that is now being covered up, as well as Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Of Johann von Leers and his conversion to Islam and relocation in the Middle East, Martin Lee writes, "Several German propaganda experts adopted Arabic names when they emigrated to Egypt. Johann von Leers, one of the Third Reich's most prolific Jew baiters, converted to Islam and became Omar Amin von Leers. He got a job with the Egyptian Information Ministry thanks to the good offices of the Grand Mufti. With von Leers in charge, Cairo's anti-Israeli propaganda machine turned out hate literature and inflammatory broadcasts on a regular basis. Assisting von Leers were dozens of European Nazis who welcomed a fresh opportunity to continue their vendetta against the Jews. They had regular access to Radio Cairo, which utilized a powerful CIA-constructed transmitter to spread this message throughout much of the Arab world. Taking a cue from von Leers, Hans Oppler, another Goebbels operative, changed his name to Shalah Safar when he started perpetrating anti-Semitic material for the Nasser regime. And Louis Haydn, alias Louis Al-Hajj, a wartime employee of the German press agency, pitched in by translating Hitler's Mein Kampf into Arabic. The Egyptian government also published an Arabic version of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the infamous forgery concocted by the Tsarist secret police, which Nasser recommended to a visiting Indian journalist in 1958. "It's very important that you should read it," the Egyptian president explained. "I will give you a copy. It proves, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that 300 Zionists, each of whom knows all the others, govern the fate of the European continent." And still more about this Nazi diaspora. In particular, Vollweber, he was a German spy who was doubling for both the East and the West, skipping down here and speaking about some of the Nazis who were going to work directly for the Arabs. In order to understand the degree of continuity between World War II European fascism and its counterpart in the Middle East, which has evolved to this day, after what we're going to be talking about here, in particular, Vollweber had his eyes on Bernhard Bender, a Middle East expert who once held the rank of lieutenant colonel on Himmler's personal staff. Himmler was head of the SS. After the war, Bender resurfaced in Cairo, where he served as chief of the political department of Nasser's secret police. So again, in terms of understanding how this all evolved, it's very important to understand how Skorzeny, Otto Skorzeny, who, as we looked at in For the Record 558, headed up the CIA contingent that was relocating all of these war criminals to work for Nasser. And, well, it's important to understand the degree of continuity between the present and the past. Speaking, by the way, of Yasser Arafat, he was a protege not only of the Grand Mufti, but also of Otto Skorzeny. The Nazis on the Egyptian payroll, by the way, again, this was the genesis of this was a CIA mission under Skorzeny that we looked at in For the Record 558, and that had, among others, Adolf Eichmann working for it. The Nazis on the Egyptian payroll were engaged in more than just a war of words. According to the Times of London, in addition to serving as advisors to the Egyptian army, German war veterans were also instructing Arab volunteers in guerrilla tactics for possible action against British troops in the Suez Canal zone. The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung subsequently reported that Otto Skorzeny had met with Colonel Nasser to discuss the training of commando troops. Several young Palestinian refugees, including Yasser Arafat, joined the Egyptian soldiers who were learning the ways and means of unconventional warfare. Although initially the intended target was the British, the future PLO chief realized that vigorous commando exercises would help prepare the Palestinian militants who were eager to renew the battle for their lost homeland. A grateful Arafat recognized Skorzeny's abundant skills in this area, and the two men struck up a relationship that lasted for many years. Apparently, the Palestinian leader was quite fond of the scar-faced Nazi paladin. Arafat would have done anything for Otto, unquote, remarked Ilse Skorzeny, Skorzeny's widow. And so, again, that's one of the things that one should understand as one attempts to penetrate the Matrix. Also, in terms of analyzing the Middle East, one never hears about the fact that the Palestinians, who are dirt poor, specifically the average Palestinian family, and they have huge families as a rule, often with numbers of children in the double digits, they have an average per annual income per family of $1,500 a year. The late Yasser Arafat, when he died by most reckoning, was the sixth wealthiest man in the world, with a personal fortune at close to $15 billion, although that's B as in billion, although the French Treasury police are still trying to unravel the many, many billions of dollars that were secreted away in foreign bank accounts. But Arafat was one of the wealthiest men in the world, and the Palestinians are among the poorest, and there is a direct relationship between those. And yet, the Palestinian side, the apologists, I would say, for the Palestinian side, never take into account that profound relationship. Why is it that the Palestinians are among the poorest peoples on earth, and yet their hero, their leader, their fearless leader, Yasser Arafat, protege of the Grand Mufti, protege of Otto Skorzeny, was among the wealthiest people on earth? That is not an accident. We're going to be talking about a lot of things in weeks to come as we begin to penetrate the Matrix. Again, I've talked a little bit about the history of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I'm going to give a thumbnail synopsis of that, although, again, I don't database information on that for reasons I've explained. I'm also going to be going more into Islamic fascism and how it is relevant today. And also, we're going to go into distortions, media distortions, the Matrix, concerning what is actually going on there. We're going to be taking a look at distortions in journalistic coverage of the Arab-Palestinian conflict, in particular some really Orwellian Matrix-like manipulation in the most recent conflict in Lebanon. It's not to say it wasn't brutal, of course, it was war. Which, as William Tecumseh Sherman said, is hell. And it is the worst thing in the world. But the coverage in this country has been badly skewed, and indeed all over much of the world. And we're going to talk about the Matrix and what actually happened and what didn't happen. And that is going to be extremely difficult, I think, for a lot of people to accept. Because, frankly, the big lie is a tough, tough thing to deal with. Because, as Hitler noted, again, in Mein Kampf, most people tell little lies. They would be ashamed to tell big ones. They would never credit others with such great impudence as the complete reversal of facts. Even explanations would long leave them in doubt and hesitation, as any trifling detail would dispose them to accept a thing as true. All good liars, therefore, know this and stop at nothing to achieve this end. We're going to continue. We're going to talk about a lot of things, including a very thoughtful article by Greg Palast about, was the invasion of Iraq a Jewish conspiracy? Something that's very much extant in the so-called progressive sector. We're going to talk about the Israel lobby, and is it really so powerful? This is from Stephen Zunas, himself a critic of Israel. And we're going to be talking about the coverage of the Middle East, where we're going to be talking about a lot of things. We're going to be talking about the OJ case and what actually happened and what people were led to believe happened. But by way of closing, I'm simply going to read a little bit of the accounting of the Middle East Matrix. We won't be able to cover this whole article. I will put it in its entirety in the description for the program. It will be read in its entirety in future broadcasts. This is an article by Tom Gross in the National Post of Canada, a mainstream Canadian paper. The National Post posted this, so to speak, on Wednesday, August 2nd of 2006. It's Dateline London. It's headlined, "The Media War Against Israel. The Jewish state is fighting not one enemy but two, Hezbollah and those who peddle its propaganda. It reads in part, large sections of the international media are not only misreporting the current conflict in Lebanon, they are actively fanning the flames. The BBC World Service has a strong claim to be the number one villain. It has come to sound like a virtual propaganda tool for Hezbollah. As it attempts to prove that Israel is guilty of committing, quote, war crimes, unquote, and, quote, crimes against humanity, unquote, it has introduced a new charge, one which I have heard several times on air in recent days. The newscaster reads out carefully selected audience comments, unquote. Among these are invariably contained some version of the claim that Israel's attack on Lebanon will serve as a recruitment, unquote, drive for Al-Qaeda. But if anything is going to win new recruits for Osama bin Laden and his like, it will not be Israel's defensive actions, which are far less damaging than Western TV stations would have us believe, but the inflammatory and one-sided way in which they are being reported by those very same news organizations. While the slanted comments and interviews are bad enough, the degree of pictorial distortion is even worse. From the way many TV stations worldwide are portraying it, you would think that Beirut has begun to resemble Dresden and Hamburg in the aftermath of Second World War air raids. International television channels have used the same footage of Beirut over and over, showing the destruction of a few individual buildings in a manner which suggests half the city has been razed. A careful look at aerial satellite photos of the areas targeted by Israel and Beirut shows that certain specific buildings housing Hezbollah command centers in the city's southern suburbs have been singled out. Most of the rest of Beirut, apart from strategic sites such as airport runways used to ferry Hezbollah weapons in and out of Lebanon, has been left pretty much untouched. We're going to be talking about this at greater length in weeks to come, including the military campaign itself, which was badly botched, and whether that was just incompetence, and I think incompetence on the part of the Israeli leadership was one of the factors here. Olmert and Peretz are rather like the Israeli equivalent of Bush and Rumsfeld, i.e. they do not simply in and of themselves know how to wage war, and that was one of the things that led to an over-reliance on air power, which you cannot use in this type of capacity, and that did maximize civilian casualties in more than, let's say, than the original military plan would have, but there's also been deliberate examination. We're going to revisit the subject of Bormann Jews. There are actually some Bormann Jews in Israel. Is Olmert one of them? Or is he merely incompetent? But we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about the economics of media, how Arab investors and their allies pretty much control most of the major media outlets in this and other countries. Yeah, no, it ain't the Jews, folks. It's recycled petro wealth. And we're going to be revisiting Serpenwalk, the Nazi tract that talks about a takeover of the world in the mid-21st century by a Third Reich that went underground. It is actually reality portrayed as fiction. And if you want to see reality portrayed as fiction, you just stick around with the way the world is going, and you're going to see reality that should be fiction, unfortunately. However, that's what we're going to be talking about in weeks to come. It's going to be a bumpy ride, so hang on as we attempt to pierce the Middle East matrix. And remember that he who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. Do use the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com, WFMU, www.wfmu.org, and the many, many linked websites with books, descriptions, articles, search functions, and a page to click on to contribute to the effort that I'm doing. If you don't like what you see, there's no better way of combating it than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 565, Middle East Matrix. He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of 9 Villages, Part 2. This has been recorded on August 20th of 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.